Thank you. So I'll start by just giving you an overview of our regulatory framework. You could maybe better understand some of the idiosyncrasies of regulation. And then I'll talk about how we regulate currently, and in particular, genome editing, how it's regulated. And you may or may not know that we've been trying to revise our regulations for many years now, and we've recently proposed, just within the last month, a new proposed rule, and I'll briefly discuss that and the implications it has for the regulation of genome editing. So the coordinated framework is the regulatory framework that was created by the Office of Science and Technology Policy in 1986. And there are three very relevant principles. They're still relevant today. One is that the risks of GE organisms are not fundamentally different from risks posed by non-GE organisms with similar traits. And that's a very important concept, and our regulation really doesn't follow that guiding principle. And that was one of the reasons why we proposed some change to our regulation. That the existing laws provide adequate authority, and I'll describe in a minute how we are using our existing laws for our regulatory authority. And that the regulation should be science-based and conducted on a case-by-case basis. And again, that is something that, even though the coordinated framework is very clear that that's how we should be regulating, that it should be science-based, historically our regulations have not been very science-based. So there are three different agencies under the coordinated framework that regulate biotechnology, the USDA, the FDA, and the EPA, and we each have different protection goals, and that's a very important thing to remember. Because if I'm going to be discussing to you what the USDA's policy is with regulation, it may be inconsistent with these other agencies. And that's because we each have different protection goals. Our goal is to protect plant health, and from our authority, that means to protect agriculture from plant pests and noxious weeds. And the FDA is concerned with food safety, and the EPA is concerned with pesticide use. So let me just kind of give you an idea of what we mean by statutory authority. Our ability to regulate is based on laws that were written by Congress. Congress wrote something called the Plant Protection Act, which specifically gives APHIS the authority to regulate plant pests and noxious weeds. Now, we take that law and we write regulations based on that law, and that's where the regulations come from. So the authority comes from Congress, and the regulations come from the executive branch, where we write the regulations that explain the technical, operational, and legal details necessary to implement the laws. And in our case, the biotech regulation is in a regulation called 7 CFR 340. CFR stands for the Code of Federal Regulation. And there is another relevant regulation that APHIS uses to regulate noxious weeds called 7 CFR 360. So I mentioned a protection goal. Our goal is to protect agricultural plants and agriculturally important natural resources from damage caused by organisms that pose plant, pest, or noxious weed risks. So whenever we consider whether to regulate a GMO, we really need to tie it back to this authority about regulating plant pests and noxious weeds and those impacts on agriculture. The current regulatory trigger asks whether or not an organism has been genetically engineered, or is it a plant pest, or does it have to be a potential to be a plant pest? And this has been a problem in terms of a science basis, because it's really not risk-based. It really comes down to whether or not you use agrobacterium, and that picture shows a crown gall, which is a plant pest, and the agrobacterium that's used for genetic engineering really isn't a plant pest, and whether or not you have sequences from an agrobacterium or a viral promoter that's commonly used in genetic engineering, that is the trigger. And there's a dissociation of risk from what actually triggers our regulation. So that was a problem that I'll describe why we wanted to revise our regulations to address and make the regulation more risk-based. Well, if you are regulated by the USDA, our regulatory instrument is a permit, or notification is a type of a permit. It's a little bit streamlined. There are certain criteria for notification, not necessary to get into that, but if you are regulated, there are three activities that are regulated. One is when if you import a genetically engineered organism into the United States, or if you move it across state lines, or if you release it into the environment. And if you are regulated, you need to go through a process to get out from regulation, and that's called a petition for non-regulated status. And we've reviewed 130 such petitions, which involve 18 plant species. It takes about 12 to 14 months. And one of the documents that our agency prepares during that review is called an environmental assessment or environmental impact statement, which considers the environmental impacts if you have that unconfined release of that genetically engineered organism in the environment. Now, we have 130 petitions, but of those 130 petitions, many are for pretty much the same thing. Like, we have had many petitions for glyphosate-resistant corn or soybean, and in those cases, any event has been reviewed separately. So that's a process we call event-by-event regulation, and that's something else that we've been trying to get rid of in the new regulations, because we think it wastes your time and ours to be looking at the exact crop, trait, mechanism of action. Not all organisms are regulated under 7 CFR 340. For those of you who heard Dr. Klee's talk, he referred to the Am I Regulated process. The Am I Regulated process asks whether or not, it gives you the opportunity to ask us whether or not your organism meets that trigger that I described before about whether it's a plant pest and it's genetically engineered. And we have published all the letters of inquiry and our responses on our website. So let me give you a brief summary of some of the errors, the Am I Regulateds, that we've had since 2011. There have already been 80, so it's quite a lot compared to the number of petitions, which we've been doing that since the early 90s. And I've broken this table down into four categories. So of that 80 since 2011, 32 had no plant pest component. So you heard some talks today about the lipofection using DNA-free delivery. Well, you know, you're not using a plant pest component there. So those would be, if you asked us in an Am I Regulated, those would not trigger our regulations. And there were three that were actually regulated of that 80. And they were regulated because they did use plant pest components. And then there's another category I have here called null segregants or epigenetics, where we've had six inquiries where the DNA was actually not modified at all. And so there are some policy decisions that are coming out of some of these decisions. So if you're working in this space, it would be good to read those letters because you can infer some policy decisions from that. So in the case of the epigenetics, you've had phenotypes where you have not modified the DNA. We have concluded that those don't trigger our regulations. And I think the one category that would interest you the most would be these site-directed nuclease cases, the indels, or the genome editing. We've had 27 so far, and we've had a whole host of nucleases that we've had inquiries for, from meganucleases, zinc finger nucleases, TALENs, and CRISPR. We've had the most. We've had 15, and of those 15, we've made decisions on 14. One is still pending, and they've all been not regulated. So there's been some movement to help reduce regulatory burden with some of these genome edited cases under our current regulation. And the people who are benefiting the most from these errors, taking the most benefit, are small businesses. You can see that at least half of the MI regulators were from small business, 12% from large business, and academics. You heard Dr. Klee is one of them, have been taking advantage of the error process. So that's all I want to say about the current regulations. Let me now go into our efforts to revise the regulation. And this was a timeline, and since 2004, we've been trying to revise our regulations. Well, why does it take so long? Well, it takes so long. There are political considerations. There are, when you change the administration, and the new administration could say, well, I don't trust the old people, so withdraw the rule. So let me just go over that. There are several parts that happen. There's a process that's called notice and comment rulemaking. The notice, the NOI that you see up there, that stands for notice of intent. That's the first step. We publish a notice of intent that we want to revise our regulations. We did that first in 2004. And then we work on a proposed rule, and we publish that, and we publish an environmental impact statement that analyzes what would be the environmental impacts from proposing that rule. And it took us several years the first time to get out the proposed rule and the environmental impact statement. So in 2007 and 2008, we got it out. Honestly, it wasn't so good. So we were not surprised that that one got withdrawn. Everyone complained about it. That could be a good regulation if everybody's unhappy, but we were unhappy with it too. It took us 7 years to get that withdrawn because of political considerations. And so now we're back into 2016, which was in the second half of Vilsack's term as an administrator of, the Secretary of Agriculture. And so we published a notice of intent in 2016, and we got a proposed rule and a draft environmental impact statement published on January 19th, 2017. And I don't know if that means anything to you if you're in Washington. That's the day before Trump's inauguration. Two more minutes. Okay, so you see, as soon as we published it, we have a new administration, and that got withdrawn. So some of the things that we've been trying to do in the proposed rule was to eliminate unnecessary regulatory burdens. We want to make the risk management actions commensurate with the degree of risk. And so the proposed rule has several off-ramps to get out from under regulation. What's above the line is something that you as a developer can do. You can make a self-determination whether an exemption applies. And I'll describe what some of those exemptions are. Hopefully I'll have a little leeway in time. Then products of biotechnology go into this funnel where we do the regulatory process, but there's another off-ramp where we're talking about doing a regulatory status review very early in the process, even based just on the sequence, the genotype, and the expected phenotype. And so you wouldn't need to be submitting field data to us. We wouldn't be doing event-by-event regulation, and the regulatory trigger would just be based on whether or not you have a pathway to harm that based on our risk assessment. The exemptions need to be conservative because we are not going to be looking at whether the exemptions, you qualify for an exemption. You're going to self-determine it, and it's going to be based on some sequence characteristics that are easily determined by you. So we want these to be very conservative exemptions. And basically, the exemptions revolve around whether the DNA modifications commonly occur within conventional breeding. So here are the exemptions. If it's a deletion, so the change to the plant is solely a genetic deletion of any size. If you can determine that you have made just a deletion, you can self-determine that's exempt. Or if you make a single base pair substitution. And again, these are proposed. And we expect that there may be some tweaking against those exemptions. And I would encourage you to read a proposed rule and make comments to us so that they can inform. Hopefully, the next step will be a final rule instead of us withdrawing it again. We have another exemption if you have an insertion from a compatible relative. So, for example, I've heard talks about getting alleles that might confer disease resistance. If that is a naturally occurring allele and you do some homologous replacement in using your genome editing and you can make many substitutions, that would be okay if you had a naturally occurring allele. And then if the offspring is a genetically engineered plant that does not retain the change of the plant parent, that is also exempt. Let me just say a few words about the regulatory status review. So the analysis is at the level of the GE plant trait mechanism of action. And so that's where we get away from event by event. For like say we have glyphosate-resistant corn, and that glyphosate-resistant corn is the trait is EPSBA synthase. We do that one time, that would go into a database, and we would never need to do glyphosate-resistant corn again. The initial review for plant pest risk is based on the genotype and the expected phenotype. So you don't even need to make the plant to be able to ask us to do a regulatory status review. You would send us what the sequence was and what was the intended change and what was the intended phenotype. We expect to know what the mechanism of action is. And if you don't know, like I think I heard one talk where they were kind of doing random insertions looking for phenotypes. If you don't know how it acts, we may be a little bit more reluctant to just give you, say, there's no pathway to harm there. Field trials are not needed in most cases, and then if risks are identified, then a more complete assessment is undertaken, and we may have specific questions for you. Okay, no event by event regulation, and I think I'm done. Thank you.
I think next we are going to invite all our speakers and moderators and on the stage, and we are going to kick off our panel discussion. And everybody can ask any questions related to the talk.
Yeah, you can come on. I don't know if we are going to move it.
Be after your transfection.
So that the GFP. Okay.
Yes. So after transformation with the Cas9 GFP fused protein, for how long you can still observe the GFB expression in the protoplast cell?
We found that the signal just gradually increased, right? But at 6 hours after the treatment, you can clearly see it under the microscope.
Go ahead.
I think my question to Dr. Wang about strawberry works. It seems like you mentioned you compared like CPF1 and Cas9. Can you give us some information about the, in terms of like the efficiency for the editing between these two, which one works better? Thanks.
So the CPF1 and Cas9 construct actually from the Alfred. So do you wanna explain?
Yeah. I can give some comments about this one. The CPF1 and we modified it's plant modified optimized codon. And CPF1 we tried in different plant species and tetraploid, tobacco, lettuce, petunia. As well as strawberry. We found CPF1 is significantly lower than the Cas9, the regular SP Cas9. We also have a high fidelity Cas9 called Hyper Cas9, also have NG Cas9, Cas9 NG. NG Cas9, Hyper Cas9, X Cas9, is the efficiency is similar, but the CPF1 seems like very temperature dependent. I believe some other labs already tried, gave the heat shock at 37 degrees, maybe several hours, maybe 12 hours, can greatly improve the gene editing efficiency. But to me, it's still not comparable to the Cas9, especially for the SP Cas9.
And actually one thing important is polyploid. So I didn't explain enough for my seminar. So when you look at the octoploid, basically you have 8 copies. And PDS has 8 copies. Then the question is, all 8 copies, they are functional? But actually not. And there are actually only 2 copies are functional. That's been actually the publication by the Richard Harrison, the plant method paper just published a few months ago in UK. So the manual case, the strawberry genome has dominant effect. So even the many copies, some of the genes collect the destroyed function, and we see the manual gene is just broken piece of DNA sequence. So, and what I saw that when you use Cas9, you see the more the variation from the PDS phenotype mild to severe, like white to pale and pink and yellow, something like that. But CPF1 not. CPF1 is a more dramatic phenotype. So look like CPF1 is more the target is oriented mutation is stronger than Cas9 maybe. And also, we designed the CPF1 and Cas9 both to knock out all copies. And maybe CPF1 is more efficiently knock out all copies, all other subgenomes. Maybe Cas9, probably not. They knock out one subgenome, but not other subgenome. But knock out all subgenomes or 2 subgenomes, something like that. So based on phenotype, I didn't look at the sequence detail, but based on phenotype, Cas9 has a more variation of the phenotype. So, yeah, that would be a good comment. But
the CPF1 is different. CPF1 basically is the PAM structure is on the 5' end, which means is TTTV. So the V is non-T CGA. And also the length for the guardian RNA usually is 23 nucleotide, But for the PEM one, for the PEM for the Cas9 is 20. And also they have a lot of different strain, the CPF1. Some strains works better in the mammal cells. Some of them works better in the plant cells. Different. Any more questions from our audience? Yeah, go ahead.
I appreciate the effect USDA is trying to do to speed up the regulatory process, but you also mentioned that the administration sometimes gets in the way and sometimes the process not very science-based. I was wondering if there is anything researchers can do to have influence on the policymaking process.
Absolutely. You know, you can read our proposed rule and send in your comments.
So I have another question and about the regulatory policy. And you know that I'm working on a single-base editing and trying to breed herbicide-resistant ornamental plants and lettuce. And on a ALS1 ESPS, and how this kind of product regulated by USDA?
So under the current regulations, you could send an am I regulated inquiry about, you know, so there's, on our website, there's a process that you can read and follow that. Under if the proposed regulation becomes final, if it's just a single base pair or if it's a deletion, then in your case, it would be a single base pair substitution, you're basically changing one amino acid, you could self-determine that it wouldn't be regulated and you wouldn't even need to come to us.
Oh, great.
Well, I have a question for all of the four speakers. Current technology requires stable transformation or tissue regeneration, and that's very, very difficult for non-model crops. And do you guys have a way, is there any other way to avoid this process?
Any comments from you guys? All right, so in my lab, we started a little bit things with that and to address this problem. And we are using some narrow tubes or narrow particles and to infect the meristem, and this is particularly important for the woody plants, a perennial plant species. Unfortunately, if you're using the narrow tube and the narrow particle, and you cannot generate a stable transgenic line unless you do the for the gene editing purpose. Because you infect the meristem, you got the gene edited and shoot whatever some organs. Probably it's chimeric and it's not a stable because you don't have LB or RB, a left border and right border from agrobacteria. It's not like gene gun using physical power to integrate the plasmid DNA to the genome DNA. But, you know, this is opening a novel avenue to generate gene-edited chimeric crops, especially for the fruit trees. And you may get homozygous shoot, and they can, and once you get that one, you can do the through the vegetative propagated and to propagate the fruit trees. The transformation is really, really hard, and we also testing right now we are screening 8 different genes to improve the regeneration. And because in the same construct, we put some inducible promoter and also some other, for example, shooting enhancer genes in there to allow the plants to regenerate better. But for the perennial plants, because some plants is really hard to produce seeds, and they cannot segregate, and your product still genetic engineered, is still fall inside the USDA regulation scope.
I have a question for Tang Gong, and I saw some of your plants in the greenhouse in your presentation. Have you tried those in field, and do you see any off-type traits, or you are seeing normal plants and normal production in the field?
Okay, so he and I, we both at the same research center, so he knows what I'm doing. I have not tried, I haven't put any microspore plants in the field yet because we need USDA MI regulated process first. I didn't do that. We have observed, we have collected preliminary data in the greenhouse, and then we checked the T1 homozygous transgene free power analysis, and then we haven't observed any significant fruit size decrease yet. So, which is increasing. And then we are planning to do T2 checking this coming season. Because Florida is blessed, we have two seasons of tomato growing season. So we're going to do that. Once we are done with that, preparing manuscript, scientific manuscript, and we probably contact USDA, and then we're planning to move to field condition. So field yet, but greenhouse looks okay to me yet, so far. Thanks.
I think we already run out of time, and I think, you know, we are going to give another applause for all our speakers.